Chapter 4. The purpose of killing the leading political figures in the United States by violent assassination, allegedly by screwed-up loners, was to get Ferris F. Fremont elected. It was the only way. He could not effectively compete. Despite his aggressive campaigns, he bordered on the worthless. Some time ago, one of his aides must have pointed that out to him. "If you're going to get into the White House, Ferris," the aide must have said, "you've got to kill everyone else first." Taking him literally, Ferris Fremont did so, starting in 1963 and working his way forward during the administration of Lyndon Johnson. By the time Lyndon Johnson had retired, the field was clear. The man who could not compete did not have to. There is no point in dwelling on the ethics of Ferris Fremont. Time has already rendered its verdict, the verdict of the world, except for the Soviet Union, which still holds him in great respect. That Fremont was in fact closely tied to Soviet intrigue in the United States, backed in fact by Soviet interests, and his strategy framed by Soviet planners, is in dispute, but is nonetheless a fact. The Soviets backed him, the right-wingers backed him, and finally just about everyone, in the absence of any other candidate, backed him. When he took office, it was on the wave of a huge mandate. Who else could they vote for? When you consider that in effect Fremont was running against no one else, that the Democratic Party had been infiltrated by his people, spied on, wiretapped, reduced to shambles, it makes more sense. Fremont had the backing of the U.S. intelligence community, as they like to call themselves, and ex-agents played an effective role in decimating political opposition. In a one-party system, there is always a landslide. One asks, why should such disparate groups as the Soviet Union and the U.S. intelligence community back the same man? I am no political theoretician, but Nicholas one time said, "They both like figureheads who are corrupt, so they can govern from behind. The Soviets and the Fuzz, they're all for shadow governments. They always will be, because basically each of them is the man with the gun, the pistol to the head." No one had put a pistol to Ferris Fremont's head. He was the pistol itself, pointed at our head, pointed at the people who had elected him. Behind him stood all the cops in the world, the left-wing cops in Russia, the right-wing cops in the United States. Cops are cops. There are only divisions of rank into greater and lesser. The top cop is probably never seen. However, Nicholas was no political theoretician either. In point of fact, he had no idea how the coalition behind Fremont had formed. In fact, he had no idea it existed. Like the rest of us over those years, he simply stood amazed as prominent politicians were murdered and Fremont rose rapidly to power. What was happening made no sense. No pattern could be discerned. There is a Latin motto, when one is seeking to know who has committed a crime, that goes, "Look to see who gains." When John Kennedy was murdered, and Dr. King, and Bobby Kennedy, and the others, when George Wallace was crippled, we should have asked, "Who gains?" All men in America lost by these dreadful, senseless murders, except one second-rate man whose way was now clear to the White House, clear to get in and clear to remain, who otherwise would have had no chance. We should forgive ourselves, though, for not figuring out who was doing it and why. After all, it had never happened in the United States before, although the history of other countries is full of it. The Russians know it well. So do the English. Take Crookback Dick, as Shakespeare calls Richard III. There was the paradigm for this. Richard, who murdered his way to the throne, killing even children, and all with the excuse that nature had made him ugly. Nature had made Ferris Fremont ugly, too, inside and out. Personally, it never entered my mind. We thought of a lot of possibilities, but not really that. The Tartar mind had never schemed for the American throne until then. I do not, however, propose to write about how Ferris Fremont got to power. I propose to write about his downfall. The former story is known, but I doubt if anyone understands the way he was defeated. I intend to write about Nicholas Brady and about Nick Brady's friends. Even though I had quit my job at the bookstore to write full-time, I still liked to drop into University Music to listen to the new LPs and say hello to Nicholas, who now spent much of his time with the salesmen from the various distributors or up in the office doing paperwork. By 1953, for all intents and purposes, he managed University Music. The owner, Herb Jackman, had another store in Kensington and spent his time there. It was nearer his home. Pat still worked in Berkeley, and she and Nicholas were together most days. What I didn't know was that Herb had a heart condition. He had suffered one heart attack in 1951, and his doctor ordered him to retire. He was only 47, and he would not retire. Instead, he bought a very small store in Kensington and puttered around in it. The only day it did any business was on Saturday, whereas University Music employed 5 clerks and was busy all the time. Nicholas and Pat, of course, knew about Herb's heart condition. Sometimes on Saturday night, Herb and his buddies got together in the office at University Music and played poker, at which times I occasionally joined them. All his buddies knew about his heart condition. They were a rough bunch, but they liked him a lot. Most of them were small businessmen in the neighborhood, and they had common interests, such as all the dopers moving onto Telegraph Avenue. They could see what lay ahead. Nicholas used to say later on that what killed Herb was the drug scene on Telegraph. Before Herb died, he had time to see spade pushers offering joints to passers-by openly across the street down toward Dwight. To a straight-laced man from Oklahoma, like Herb, that would do it. I also played poker with Tony Boucher and his friends, at his house on Dana. They, like me, were all science fiction writers. Nicholas never played poker. He was too intellectual for that. Nicholas was your typical Berkeley intellectual, involved with books and records and the Avenue coffee houses. He and Rachel, when they felt like going out, crossed the bay to San Francisco and headed straight for North Beach and the coffee houses there along Grant. Before that, they stopped in Chinatown and ate dinner at exactly the same restaurant, the oldest one there, according to them, Yi Jun's, on Washington. You had to go downstairs to the basement, and the tables had marble tops. There was a short waiter there named Walter, who, it was said, fed homeless students for free, the sort filling up San Francisco, who would one day cease being the beatniks, as Herb Cain termed them, and become the Haight-Ashbury hippies. Nicholas was never a beatnik or a hippie. He was far too intellectual for that. But he resembled one, with his jeans and tennis shoes and his short beard and tousled hair. The big problem for Nicholas was the prospect of remaining a record clerk all his life. Even managing University Music seemed to be that, and it was messing up his head, especially as his wife moved toward getting her degree. Instead of going to school, he was putting his wife through school. He had the feeling that Rachel looked down on him. Berkeley being a college town, he felt that most people looked down on him. It was a difficult period for him. Obviously, his boss would have another heart attack, at which point Pat, as the legal owner of University Music, would undoubtedly put him, Nicholas Brady, in charge of the store. He would be doing what Herb had been doing, which he was virtually doing already, and it came into his mind that probably he would wind up like Herb, dead from worry and overwork at a job that gave little back, dead at an early age, at his post from 9 in the morning until midnight. Retail record selling, for the independent owner, was a losing proposition. The big chains were starting to come in, Music Box and The Warehouse, the discount record stores. At this time, Nicholas had another paranormal experience. He told me about it the next day. This one had to do with Mexico. He had never been to Mexico and knew little about it, and this was why the detail of the dream amazed him so. Every car, every building, all the people on the sidewalks and in the restaurants were so sharply etched. And it was no return to a past life because he saw yellow cabs. It was truly modern, a big city such as Mexico City itself, very busy, very noisy, but with the sounds somehow muted and at a constant background level of murmuring. In the dream, he never heard a single clear word. No one spoke to him. There were no characters, just cars, taxis, street signs, stores, restaurants. It was entirely scenic, and it rolled on and on for hours, in a strange, vivid, shiny color, the kind, Nicholas said, you find in acrylic paint. The dream had come to him oddly, during the day. At about 2 in the afternoon, on his day off, he had gotten sleepy and had lain down on the living room couch. The dream began at once. He was at a taco stand, buying a taco. But then the scene rolled open, as if doors had swung wide or lifted up. All at once he no longer stood before the taco stand, but instead faced a panorama of Mexico itself. Romantic and thrilling it was, sparkling with color in the night, drawing him toward it with many hints and promises. It fanned out in all directions, a vast foreign landscape not known to him, not a part of the contents of his own mind. Lovely, compelling, leading him on so that after a short time he was in the midst of it, with the rich life spilling by on all sides, the murmur of people, the swish of traffic, and all so real, so unmistakably real. At one point he found himself moving with a small group through a museum of some sort located at the edge of the ocean. He saw many exhibits and pictures he could not later recall, but that section alone evidently lasted for hours. The total elapsed time of the experience, in real time, was almost 8 hours. He had noticed what time it was when he lay down, and when he rose he rechecked it. 8 hours of scenic Mexico, and for no cost. Later, he said to me, it was as if another mind were trying to communicate with me. Life unlived, I think, where I might have lived, what I might have experienced. I couldn't argue with that. His constricted Berkeley life certainly cried out for such a vivid trip.
Maybe it means you should move to Southern California, I said.
No, it was Mexico, a foreign country.
Have you ever thought of moving to L.A.? He did not find that funny.
A vast mind was talking to me, across endless miles of space, from another star.
Why? I asked.
I believe it has seen my needs. I believe it intends to direct my life toward some great goal presently unglimpsed.
Nicholas got a sly, secretive look on his face.
I have a name for it. Valis System A. It stands for Vast Active Living Intelligence System A. I call it A because it may be only one out of many. It has all those characteristics. It is vast, it is active, it is intelligent, and it forms a coherent system.
You know all that from it showing you Mexico?
I sensed it there. I intuited its nature. Sometimes I lie awake at night and try to commune with it. All this has resulted from my appeals over the years. I've appealed for this many times.
I thought over the word appeal, and then realized that the word he meant was prayer. He had prayed for this, was what he intended to say, but no one in Berkeley ever used the word prayer. There was no religion in Berkeley, except among the Okies who had migrated out during World War II to work in the Richmond shipyards. Nicholas wouldn't be caught dead using the word prayer. I guessed then that he had had other experiences with Valis, as he called him. As a matter of fact, he had had other experiences, which he later told me about, dreams of a peculiar repetitive nature, in which large open books were held up before his eyes, with printing like that of old Bibles. In each dream, he either read or tried to read the printing, with meager results, at least to his conscious mind. There was no telling how much he absorbed unconsciously and repressed or forgot on awakening, probably a great deal. I had the impression, from what he said, that he was shown enough writing in his dreams to have taken the equivalent of a crash course. In what, neither he nor I could tell.